One of those on the forefront, on the green front lines when it came to climate science, is now silenced, and it is a loss that the full magnitude of which we are just beginning to anticipate with great sadness. We're talking about the untimely passing of Dr. Stephen Schneider, known to Steve by his friends and colleagues. He was a longtime educator, author, scientist, climate scientist, and most of all, a real strong advocate for communicating the complexities of climate science to policymakers, to the public, to anybody who needed to know about this, which is, of course, all of humanity, talking about humans' impact on climate and the possible consequences of continuing business as usual. One of those who knew him well, worked with him at Stanford, is someone who is one of my favorite guests, and that is Dr. Paul Ehrlich. He is a biologist and a great renowned author in his own right, longtime educator author, and you all, of course, remember the population bomb back in 1968, I believe. He has continued to go on to do great work, and his contributions, like that of Stephen Schneider, are tremendous, and I am very pleased and honored to have him with us for a few minutes to remember Stephen Schneider. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
I wish I could tell you it was a pleasure to be here, but I could think of a thousand things I'd rather be doing than this.
I know. Just so sad.
Steve is, I mean, everybody knows he was an extraordinary scientist, but he was also an extraordinary friend. And I have so many emails and so many phone calls and so on. It's even brought home to me, who I probably as close to him as anybody in the world, except for Terry. Ann and I and Terry and Steve have traveled all over the world together and so on, and it still shocked me how many people have written to me to say what a wonderful mentor and friend he had been to them and so on. It's just absolutely extraordinary, and I think Ben is undergoing the same thing. Are you still there, Ben?
No, Ben was hoping to say hello during the break, and we had some miscommunication with the studio. So
Ben Sander is another great scientist who Steve helped in many ways, and another terrific guy. There's an awful lot of really good people in climate science, and Steve, of course, in many ways was the leader. I think that I didn't hear what Ben had to say earlier, but people think of Steve often as being controversial. Actually, he's always been an extraordinarily careful scientist who did absolutely brilliant work in climate science, and I've known him since about 1972, and in those days I was doing tonight shows with Johnny Carson, and Steve went on, and we had a lot of time talking about how one does public science and how scientists should communicate to the public. And Steve was always very careful and conservative. For instance, when we were doing the nuclear winter studies, Carl Sagan wanted to really push it for good reasons, but Steve was very conservative on the science. He said, we got to be, you've heard the term nuclear winter, but Steve eventually published a paper called Nuclear Autumn because he thought the original results that our groups got were probably not conservative enough. So Steve was a very, very careful scientist. And certainly one of the fathers of public science, if you want to put it that way.
Yes, and Ben did talk about that, how his scientific warning of the possible climactic consequences of nuclear war may just have nudged our species onto a slightly different, hopefully more sustainable pathway. And you do go way back, and you mentioned that you and your wife, Anne, worked with Stephen and his wife, Terry Root, at Stanford. That must have been quite a unique friendship, personal connection.
It was very special, and, Terry is a fine scientist in her own right. She's one of the leaders working on the issue of how much organisms are going to either go extinct or change their distributions as the climate disruption proceeds. So they were certainly a natural team, and when Steve married her, they got together because of their their mutual overlapping scientific interests, and Terry's one of the world's great bird experts, and I'm a longtime birder, and Anne is a birder, and we ended up taking trips many, many places together, looking at birds, looking at the environmental situation, and Steve, with absolutely typical of Steve, he didn't know a bird from a butterfly when he really got into this, and he became a life list of thousands of birds. deceived at everything in a big way, whether it was wine or his interest in bird art or his interest in birds and so on. And despite that, he had huge amounts of time for everybody else. In other words, when any time, for instance, that I wrote any, I'm not a climate scientist, I try and follow it, and of course having Steve as a very close friend made it easy, but he was always willing to read anything Ann and I had written that impinged on climate science or on Bayesian statistics or on huge numbers of other areas where Steve was much better qualified than we were. I mean, there's sort of a cooperative of scientists who check out each other's work because we don't all know the whole story, and Steve was always somebody for just terrific at that. I had a student, ex-student of his in tears, I mean, somebody I know quite well, faculty member at another university, but called me last night just to basically console us over the loss of Steve. Just, it's a huge loss.
It is. And as you say, he was so generous with his time. As busy as he was professionally and as much as he was battling his own very serious illness, he didn't slow down, and he always would make an effort to, he was very present when you'd speak to him. You know, there was none of this looking over your shoulder. He looked you in the eye. He was right there with you, and he was really an advocate of what I have been trying to do personally for a dozen years or so, and that's bring a green talk show to mainstream radio and or television that focuses heavily on climate change challenges and solutions. And he really went out of his way to try to help me, you know, make that happen. And I can count on one hand those people who I've interviewed who actually did that. And you also were one of my favorite guests who you've also gotten the need to really educate the public by using mass media outlets. And that's why you were one of my last guests, I should mention, on my program EcoTalk, which was on the late, great Air America network back 3 years ago, back on Internet radio, because they don't cost as much money, these programs, to do.
Yeah, I know.
It's still outrageous.
I have a great granddaughter now. I mean, there's people like Steve and Ann and I and Terry just have to stay in it because there are so many kids that we really care about. But I mean, Steve had time for everybody. When he was fighting this terrible mantle cell lymphoma, which was about 7 years ago, he had a bone marrow transplant, just a truly horrendous procedure. But Ann and I would go, and we'd have to go through, you know, washing, careful sterile washing, and put on robes and so on to go in and see him. And there would be Steve and Perry sitting next to each other, Steve in the bed, Perry in a chair, and she's handing him papers, and he's desperately typing into his computer, answering people, keeping his journal going, and so on and so forth. I mean, at times when I would have just laid there and groaned. And, I mean, we saw him all the time, and he was always working. And then, as you may have mentioned before, he wrote a wonderful book on how to be a patient called The Patient from Hell. And he described how he had cooperated, and I think basically bought himself 6 or 7 more years of life by working very closely with the doctors. But once the book came out, people who had the same lymphoma started contacting him, and he took lots and lots of time to communicate with them, to tie them into the right doctors and so on. In other words, he was just the most generous person you could imagine. He always had time for everybody, except, of course, for some of the paid jerks who spent a lot of time attacking him. He didn't have much time for them.
And patience, and nor should he have. And he was fearless, as we have been saying, and courageous and generous, and leaves a legacy that is so needed right now, and that is courage and courage of convictions and, you know, impatience with the deniers. So there's no time for that. I'm sure he's touched so many that we don't even know about in terms of emboldening them. I'm one of them, you know, where I've been discouraged over the years trying to just, you know, do a green talk show. It shouldn't be so difficult in a black and white world. Sometimes it is. And yet we can't quit. We who have, especially who have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, this gives me new, I guess, dedication to continue his legacy, to communicate science to the public as a media person, putting people like you, like Stephen, like Ben Santer on mainstream media outlets to talk about the urgencies, the challenges, and what we can do to slow it down, if not turn it around.
I think that's the very best thing you can do to honor Steve's memory. And as I said, like you, I've been just stunned by the breadth of the support and the caring that's appeared from just everywhere. And I knew that there would be a huge fuss, but I didn't have any idea of the scale of it. We are, by the way, we're going to have a celebration of his life sometime during the academic year at Stanford. We can't put the plans together yet. First of all, very few people are around Stanford at the moment, but we're going to have to find out when people can attend and when we can get a venue and so on. But Steve will be remembered in a big way with some kind of big celebration at Stanford, and hopefully we'll be able to contact you and
please do
see if we can get some good coverage for it.
Please do, absolutely. And you mentioned that he was so beloved by anyone he touched, and it's so true. And yet everyone knows Al Gore, and yet outside the environmental and climate communities, not enough people knew the name Dr. Stephen Schneider.
That's true, and Stephen Schneider knew Al quite well. I mean, let me say something nice about Al. When we were doing the nuclear winter stuff, and Steve and his group were doing the climatic side, and I and a bunch of colleagues were doing the what's going to happen to biology if the climate's that way side, Gore was the only one who came personally to our hearings. Everybody else in the Congress sent staff, but Al came in person and learned the stuff himself, and he really learned it well. So I always had a warm spot in my heart for him for doing that. I wish we had more people in Congress today who would take the time to learn the critical science that everybody really has to know. In other words, we have a culture gap where so many people in our society know nothing at all about the critical issues facing humanity. And unfortunately, that includes a very large portion of our legislature. And that's not healthy.
And we can only wonder what might have happened if Al Gore had been the first real green president in the White House.
Indeed. Just pass the bottle of gin again, will you?
There is climate change legislation being debated still in Senate, being watered down probably as we speak. How hopeful are you, Paul, that Congress is going to do the right thing?
Let's put it this way. I'm not hopeful that Congress will do the right thing this time around. But starting is necessary. You've got to get a start. And that's what Steve would have said. In other words, you can't come up with a perfect plan right away. You will not be able to persuade people instantly to do the right. I mean, what we obviously need, as far as I'm concerned, and this depends on my full trust of people like Ben Sainer and Steve Schneider, that if they're right, we should be having a World War II type mobilization right now to change the subsidy system away from fossil fuels, to do everything possible to get on a sustainable energy program, to do everything possible to stop population growth, at least among the rich, because they're the ones who are using the fossil fuels and wrecking the atmosphere much more at the moment than the poor. The poor are trying very hard to catch up. But these are things that are not popular. But, I mean, we do know we can change the consumption habits of a nation in 4 or 5 years dramatically. Well, we knew that by the World War II mobilization and demobilization. But you need the political will to get that sort of thing done, and you got to start someplace. And at least if we're started, when nasty events start piling up, people will know what direction to move. So I'm not optimistic at all that we'll get a satisfactory bill through Congress this year. I'm optimistic that if people start learning this stuff, we can at least have a good shot at turning the situation around before we're cooked. But I don't see any sign of that move yet.
Well, that's why we need, at least this kind of programming on mainstream media outlets to connect the dots for more Americans so they understand what's at stake for them and the challenges that are here upon us, on our shores,
Steve and I were both desperately worried about the whole media situation. I mean, you have the system now where paid people write lies. Look how Climate Gate came. It was a bunch of
people. Well-paid people. If you're talking about Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh.
Get it on the blogs, then false news, Fox News picks it up and pushes it hard enough so that the mainstream media, most of the people in it know nothing at all about the scientific issues, then pick it up, and all of a sudden you have Climate Gate. Absolute pure nonsense. Mm-hmm. Virtually every attack on the IPCC has missed the point that it is the most carefully vetted scientific effort ever on the face of this planet, large-scale scientific effort. And the percentage of errors, you're always going to have little mistakes in science. You're always going to have uncertainties. Science never proves anything. But when you have thousands of scientists saying, we're in deep trouble, to just turn the other way and make up stories. By the way, sorry, I'm gibbering, but...
That's okay.
Have you seen Oreskes' book? It's called The Merchants of Doubt, I think.
I have seen it. I haven't read it. I've heard about it.
Well, it's you might even try and get her on, because she shows that some of the very same people who were paid by the cigarette industry to insert doubt and uncertainty about whether smoking was good for you or not and killed millions of people, you can trace them right down to some of the same people who are now, in my view, probably killing millions of people by stalling very effectively getting any real effort on climate disruption.
Okay, Paul, since I have one of the world's premier experts on population growth, I have to use the segue here to ask you what you're up to, what you're working on. And when you wrote The Population Bomb, what was the global population? And I'm thinking, I've got this picture in my head of that scene in An Inconvenient Truth, one of the most shocking moments in the movie where Al Gore looks at what's happening to population, and it just,
well,
there's a spike.
When Ann and I wrote The Population Bomb, there were 3.5 billion people. Now there's twice as many, basically. What I'm working on now is the Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior. Steve and I were both involved in it, lots of other scientists, because all the scientists who try and look at the entire global situation are convinced, basically, that we know more than enough science to know what we ought to be doing. Like, even dumb economists know that we ought to be charging more for gasoline, that sort of thing. And yet we're not seeing it doing it. The problem is behavior. The problem is human behavior. It's not that we don't know enough about the science. We know that racism is nonsense biologically. We still have racism. We know that we shouldn't be burning fossil fuels, so we invade Iraq to get more. The government hasn't even told people that the Gulf oil spill, that you would have to have several hundred of those going constantly with automobile gasoline just to keep American cars going. In other words, the scale at which we are using fossil fuels is unbelievable. We can't get any action, so we're having a big symposium at the Ecological Society meeting on the Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior, looking at the issue of how do we learn to change our behavior to save our skins.
The height of fossil foolishness, and since you did mention the Gulf oil kill, can't call it a spill, you know, what will it take if not this perfect storm? Don't forget the coal mine disaster that killed, 29 miners right before the Earth Day, 40th anniversary of Earth Day explosion of the Deepwater Horizon. The oil, you know, still gushing, and the consequences of which, after having Ricky Ott on the program, will last decades to come.
Oh, yeah,
along the Gulf Coast.
The use of the dispersants to just try and protect BP, I mean, it's shameful.
If this doesn't wake us up, what will?
This should have been used as a teaching tool. Even if they get it capped now, it was a big, visible, stupid, and idiotic environmental disaster. And it should have been used as a teaching tool, and it isn't. And so my colleagues and I are not cheered, and the loss of Steve Schneider is certainly the worst blow I can imagine on the climate front from a public relations and science perspective is just ghastly, and I'm not being unprejudiced, because he was a wonderful, wonderful close friend to us.
Well, he was a wonderful friend to everyone he touched, and you are fortunate to have known him as well as you and your wife did. And he only was at Stanford, I guess, since 1996, and yet look at the work he did while there. Look at the people he touched while there. Before that, he was, I guess, with the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. I should probably
One of our great triumphs was stealing him away from NOAA.
right. And I'm so glad that we had him in the Bay Area, because I was, you know, many of us were fortunate enough to hear him on many a panel. I never missed a lecture from him, because it was never boring. It was never repetitive. it was always right on. And then he was just as pleasant to speak to afterwards, always. That was among his gifts, you know, that personal connection. We just have a couple more minutes, Paul, and I really thank you for taking the time to be with us at this sad time. Any parting thoughts on what his legacy might be in the best circumstances?
My greatest hope is that he'll prove to be a wonderful role model for the young generation of scientists in general, and particularly atmospheric scientists who are coming along. And Steve was very much involved, as was I, in the Aldo Leopold Leadership Program, which was basically a program to try and train scientists to give testimony to Congress, to talk in public, to go on TV and radio and so on. And I hope that his legacy will be a growing number of scientists who understand that their major responsibilities. When I was trained, it was do your research and then publish it so you can tell other scientists about it. And a lot of us have been pushing the scientific community to add to that and tell the public why it's important and what it means. And that's where Steve was a leader, and hopefully we're going to have a great generation of scientists following Steve's lead and doing that, because as you perfectly know, it's important to be able to get scientists who are willing to talk to the public.
Willing and able to be so clear and consistent and use humor in describing what we're facing.
Absolutely.
Humor is a good thing, and I thank you for yours.
If you can't keep your sense of humor in this world, you're in really deep trouble.
Absolutely. Lord knows that's what's gotten me through, trying to be a green radio pioneer in a black and white world and leaving me in the red. But I'm still here. You're still there. And so there's hope. But
You'll have Sarah Palin. She'll keep your sense of humor up.
Yeah, Sarah Palin's going to do a nature show right on the Discovery Channel, getting paid $2 million an episode at last report. Oh, my gosh. You can't make this stuff up, can you, Paul?
But you know, she can see nature from her front porch. So after all, she is an expert.
Right. God, may she stay there in Alaska.
Amen.
Thank you so much, Paul Ehrlich, for your leadership.
My great pleasure, Betsy. I hope we do it again sometime.
I hope so, too. It's comforting to know you're still working hard and spreading the green message, and I hope we can talk again soon.
But me, too. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
That's it for this edition of The Green Front. I am very pleased that you could join us on this special edition remembering the life and legacy of Dr. Steven Snyder. If you don't know who we're talking about and you'd like to learn more, just Google him. There's all kinds of wonderful eulogies. Tell your friends they can listen to this program, because you just heard two fellow scientists who knew him well, Ben Santer and Paul Ehrlich. I'm pleased to have had them with us. And we really appreciate your attention to green issues, because guess what? They're for all of us, or at least those of us who eat, breathe, or drink. Last time I checked, that was just about everyone. Thanks for joining me. See you next time. In the meantime, have a great green week. And remember, environment matters.